Curtis Hill's nearly week-long disciplinary hearing, Pete Buttigieg's poll numbers in Iowa, plus Mike Braun's climate caucus, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 25th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Attorney General Curtis Hill faced an attorney disciplinary hearing over allegations he groped four women at a party last year. Monday, Hill's four accusers took the witness stand. State Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon and three legislative staffers, Samantha Lozano, Nikki DeSilva, and Gabrielle Brock. They each testified about the night in question and what they've experienced since. Reardon described Hill as a, quote, creeper. DeSilva says she felt white-hot anger when he touched her. And Brock says she regrets coming forward because Hill hasn't faced any consequences for his actions. Tuesday, most of the witnesses were called to corroborate the women's accounts. They described Hill as impaired, creepy, and predatory at the 2018 party. Wednesday, a bombshell. A former employee of Curtis Hill's when he was Elkhart County prosecutor testified that he made an explicit sexual advance to her. Thursday, Hill told his side of the story on the witness stand before the hearing came to a close. He described being, in his words, shocked and troubled last year when he learned people accused him of acting inappropriately. Unlike many of the witnesses who testified, Hill said he wasn't drunk or impaired at the party, and he said while he put his hand on many people's backs, he denied touching anyone inappropriately or in a sexual manner. Does this change anything for Curtis Hill? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Elise Schrock, did the disciplinary hearing really change much?
I think it did. I think that prior to the disciplinary hearing, over the past year and a half, that we've not seen the Attorney General... face any consequences for his actions or the alleged actions. It was mostly talked about in kind of the political chattering class. Now, after the hearing, after multiple days, I don't think anyone thinks that who is watching this from the chattering class thinks he's any less guilty. And I think that the observation has moved far outside of that. I think this is now much further into the greater public than it was before.
Do you think that's true? Has this story started to spread because of these 4 days of just, like, day-long testimony?
I don't know that I think that the story has spread that far into kind of the average voter or the public as much, but I do think that this week has changed a lot because I think the testimony was very damning. It's a lot more information and a lot more detail and context than what people had had before. The testimony from one of his former employees that he had propositioned was new and incredibly disturbing. I think that for a couple of reasons, big things are happening. So before there were Republicans and supporters of his who wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think that it's impossible to see all of this and believe that all of these people misunderstood what he said or what he did.
It went beyond the four women.
What they saw or what they felt. And so I'm not an attorney. I don't know how this plays out legally. But politically, what it demonstrates to me is that he cannot win re-election. So the public hasn't seen it yet, but I am certain that the testimony is going to find its way into television and radio and digital ads, and it will be crushing for him politically. So I think the big question now is Republicans need to figure out who they want to be their attorney general and come up with a convention strategy, because if we nominate him at the convention, we will lose the general election.
The unknown here is obviously what happens with the disciplinary commission complaint. We won't know that for months, literally months now, and certainly no final decision probably. We might not have a final decision before the Republican convention next summer.
It would probably be. Probably will.
Maybe. But The next real question for Curtis Hill in terms of that political consequence is the convention. Do you think that this week's hearings changed some of those minds?
I will agree that the testimony was plentiful and damning, especially since we heard from an accuser involved in an earlier stage of his career. Having said that, I'm not sure that it necessarily changed the needle. The needle already, you had two camps. You know, you had people who thought for months, if not a year ago, that this is somebody who needed to be out of office. You also had supporters who said, you know, he's getting a raw deal, people are misconstruing his actions, or that's at best or at worst, people are out to get him. There's some sort of conspiracy. And I'm sure that when his back was to the wall, as it was this week, there is a group of supporters who say, you know, this invigorates them. This gives them justification that, see, they're going after our guy. Yeah. So the real question, I think, will be the formal decision by the Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission, because that takes it out of the realm of speculation. If, in fact, he is disbarred, which there are a range of things that the Supreme Court certainly could do, that being
the most serious,
that would answer the question we have before us, which is, would he seek re-election or win re-election? Because if he's disbarred and is not an attorney, he cannot, under Indiana law,
be an attorney general. I don't think anyone thinks he's getting disbarred. No. Suspensions are pretty rare in the disciplinary commission, and I think that's the most anyone is, you know,
realistically expecting.
But that's still going to affect if he's eligible to be attorney general. And we'll
absolutely.
Send that
he has to have a valid license. Yeah. And I do think it puts him in a box, though, with not being able to, you know, he hasn't officially said he wants to run for re-election. He would have to file sometime in mid-May if he was going to file for the convention. You know, is he raising money now? Is he acting like he's running without saying so, with this thing kind of hovering above him? I mean, I do think that puts him in a really tough spot.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question we've asked before, and so we're asking it again now. Will Curtis Hill be the Republican nominee for Attorney General in 2020? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, should the mother of the 14-year-old Richmond school shooter face felony charges for, among other things, pulling her son out of mental health treatment? 30% of you say yes, 70% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. House Speaker Brian Bosma and former Senate President Pro Tem David Long testified at that Curtis Hill disciplinary hearing this week about what happened in the wake of the alleged incident. Bosma and Long said they first learned of the allegations that Curtis Hill groped four women, a state lawmaker, and three legislative staffers about 2 months after the incidents purportedly took place. They almost immediately initiated an internal investigation conducted by an outside law firm. But that investigation focused primarily on their roles as employers and whether they had any liability or responsibilities. It became clear in their testimony that before the accusations became public via a leak of that investigation report to the Indianapolis Star, Bosma and Long both believed the matter had been resolved.
Jennifer Hollowell, I decided to talk about this in a separate discussion because I was interested in the debate on this, which is, would it have been okay, if the memo doesn't get leaked to the press, would it have been okay for this to have been essentially settled privately and never come out and see the light of day in the public?
I think it's entirely up to the women, how they want it handled. And I certainly would understand and respect their decision if they didn't want it to be public. As it was, all these things kind of came out without their control, and then they had their voice. But I can tell you that I've been in situations, and I have friends who have been in situations that could have been reported to school officials or employers or law enforcement and chose not to, because sometimes you just prefer to move on. And so in this case, I really think it would have been or could have been up to them, and that would be the best.
That was some of the new things we heard this week, is the testimony of the four women, particularly the younger staffers, not so much Mara Candelaria Reardon, the state lawmaker, but more the younger staffers talked about, and we really heard this for the first time, about how they felt when it was coming out into the public
right at the beginning when they were still sort of anonymous, but then very quickly not. And they talked about the fear, the pain of that. So would it have been better if this had been quietly dealt with?
Well, I do agree that in these instances, it's important for any woman who is a victim of sexual harassment, assault, to feel like they have some control of the situation, because they haven't, and that's part of the trauma of these incidents. In this case, while I do think, I agree, you know, it's up to the women, I think that as an employer, as four caucus leaders, there is a duty to them to have a system, a proper system, in place for when these incidents arise. This is a state house. This is a toxic environment for women. It has been as long as it's been around. The fact that the four leaders didn't have a plan in place to address this failed those victims. And while victims are going through the, especially it's their workplace, they're worried about seeing this person in the state house. They're worried about if they're going to lose their job, if they can get a new job after this, on top of the trauma of the actual incident. So then we're also expecting them to know how the employee should handle this HR and sometimes criminal issue. That's too much onus to put on victims. And there has been a recent update to that policy. I don't think it does enough. It's been likened to a 90s-style harassment policy. I think there needs to be more of a priority, and I think they need to bring in more women when it comes to setting that policy.
So Bosman Long talked about feeling frustrated and even angry when the memo was leaked to the public, because they were trying to protect the anonymity of the women who had requested that anonymity throughout the process, and they felt like this was letting that get away from them. Can that be true on the one hand, but also a convenient excuse for them to have been able to very quietly put this off to the side?
I think it can be both, and it probably was. I think they were also frustrated that, you know, their way of dealing with it quietly, you know, got taken away. Because one thing I found striking during the testimony was, you know, Speaker Bosma saying after the meeting where they met in person with Curtis Hill, you know, they hugged at the end, they shook hands and said, "I'm sorry you're going to have to go through this," to Curtis. You know, and it was very clear. And 3 days later, they're calling for his resignation. And the only thing that happened there was it became public, and the public was appalled.
This is obviously part of this conversation is we're, as if it were all true. We can't say for sure that this happened or didn't happen. But assuming that Curtis Hill did all the things that he's accused of, if, you know, if this memo doesn't get leaked to the public, he's the attorney general right now as he is, but we're not asking questions about whether he's going to run for re-election. We're not asking questions about whether he should. We're not asking, nobody's calling for him to resign, right?
I think that's right. And that's why your question, this round here, is so important about should this have been dealt with quietly. Normally, I agree with everybody what has been said, that in these types of situations, I would give great deference to the accusers, to the women here, because of their concerns. They've already potentially been, if these are all proved to be true allegations, they've already been traumatized and victimized once. We wouldn't want to see that happen again with the embarrassment, perhaps, unfortunately, embarrassment. I wish we could get past the stigma that goes with public disclosure. But there is a wrinkle in that. And I think what makes this different is when you have these situations, who knows about it usually? You have the accusers, of course. You have the subject of the accusation, and then the supervisor, the boss, if you will, of the accused. Well, in this case, when you have a statewide elected official, I would, as naive, perhaps,
his
and silly,
his
boss are the residents of the state, is the citizenry of the state of Indiana. And therefore, we would never suggest that the supervisor in the private sector should not know about conduct, because it could cloud his or her judgment about how an employee is dealt with in the future. So why would we want to shield the supervisor, in this case happens to be 7 million people, or whatever the latest census
six point something,
I'm rounding up, who I think, again, as silly as it sounds, or Pollyanna-ish as it sounds, is in fact the supervisor for statewide elected officials.
Well, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg surged in the Democratic presidential polls in Iowa this week after a debate performance a week ago that many praised. The week began with a new USA Today Suffolk University poll of likely Iowa Democratic caucus goers. That put Buttigieg in third place, just a few points behind former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Elizabeth Warren. It's a race the Suffolk pollster calls up for grabs. Then a new poll from Iowa State University in civics puts Buttigieg second behind only Warren. He leapfrogged both Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders from a survey by the same pollster conducted just last month.
Nikki Kelly, we talked last week about his debate performance and what impact it might have. Is this, we're starting to see it?
Oh, absolutely. We already knew he was, you know, a darling of the donor network, and, you know, the money wasn't the problem, but now we're starting to see that, you know, a little bit more aggressive take is helping push him up the polls. Obviously, I think he's going to finish well in Iowa. I mean, if he finished a second, amazing. Mm-hmm. Even if he finished third, that would still be incredible for him.
For the mayor of South Bend.
Exactly. Yeah. But I do think, you know, you do have to look ahead. As much as his campaign doesn't want to, quote, look ahead, you know, you got to look ahead to places like South Carolina and that, where he's got to still figure out why he can't seem to make inroads on the minority vote.
Obviously, you know, the timing of this is such that maybe his debate performance had somewhat of a role to play, but I think Nikki just pointed out he's been doing so well in money, and that's translated, we've known, to he's got more field offices than anybody else in Iowa. They've spent a lot of time and money in Iowa so far. Is that perhaps the biggest driver
of these new numbers? I think they're both very important. I think even if you, in the absence of the debate performance he had, because of the ground game, because of the organization he has put in place, because of the extensive advertising, digital and more traditional formats, he probably would be in that top tier, in the top three. There's some interesting data. You cited a couple polls, but there are other polls or analyses that look even a step further about who are the most motivated caucus goers, who are people who are actually engaged and are, you know, come hell or high water or blizzard, determined to be there and take part in this process. And it's, if you look at that group, he's even, he actually is in the lead, I believe, by most of the analyses I've seen. So in an odd way, his biggest challenge now might be, I don't think he wants to be seen as the absolute de facto winner in Iowa before it happens,
now.
Because then if he finishes, heaven forbid, you know, who would have thought we would have said this, you know, a few months ago, if he finishes second, or nightmare of nightmares, third, that would be a death knell, perhaps. So this is where managing expectations becomes so important in this process.
I think about, we've done this and we'll do this poll again at some point, will he be the Democratic nominee for president? We've done it a lot over the last several months since he announced, and the numbers have changed steadily, getting more and more positive for him. But we're sitting just a few months out, just less than three, from the Iowa caucus, and he's in second in a poll, in a major poll in that state. Is that kind of astonishing?
I mean, it's certainly better than I thought it would be at this point. Having survived a presidential campaign, it is quite a roller coaster. So I wouldn't get too excited about one day or 1 week or 1 month even.
Yeah, you don't want to peak too soon.
That's right.
And so, and for his, for him, like, he hasn't been first, which you don't want to be first because everyone goes after you. But it also isn't all in a vacuum. You know, Bernie Sanders has been dealing with health issues that has impacted his positioning and his ability to go out and campaign. You have Joe Biden, who's been dealing with the scandal of his son. And so there was an opening to be kind of seized, and him going after Elizabeth Warren made that all happen. I think it's still too early to know what's going to happen, and then we see as each state comes on next year, momentum plays a big factor, but there are also a lot of different kinds of voting targets in those states that will impact it.
Yeah, the Iowa electorate doesn't look like much of the rest of the electorate. But if you're Pete Buttigieg, John just kind of alluded to this. How do you manage those expectations now? We talked about him plateauing it seemed like he plateaued for a while, but then this is a new boost into a different tier, really.
What's the next step? How do you manage this now?
I think it's trying to figure out how to stay steady in this next tier. You called him a darling of the donor class. It's clear that he can take those contributions and put them to work in a way that's effective. Hopefully that feeds itself. Now that he's in this next tier, he can take that whole new number that he's reached and make that work in a way that's proved to be successful in the past. But again, it is managing expectations. You don't want to pull too far ahead. I just think that we've said for almost a year now, you just have to stay steady, stay in the game, keep making yourself relevant. I mean, he keeps just doing everything
that he's supposed
to do. And he's bringing a lot of other people, new people, along with him. So,
Well, Indiana Republican Senator Mike Braun announced this week the launch of a bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus. Braun created what he says is a first-of-its-kind climate caucus with Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons. The Hoosier Republican says Washington, D.C. has been, quote, paralyzed by partisanship over the issue of climate change and unable to have productive conversations. Braun, who describes himself as a lifelong conservationist, has a timber business in southern Indiana. The Senate Climate Solutions Caucus will meet regularly and convene experts from across the political spectrum to craft what they call bipartisan solutions. It will operate through what's known as unanimous consent, acting only when every member agrees.
John Schwannis, is this a workable idea? Could we actually see solutions out of this
Climate Solutions Caucus? I'd hate to think that we've reached the point where the notion that you have people, despite their ideologies, the notion that they can come together to come up with practical solutions to significant problems, if that's somehow beyond the pale now, we're in trouble. So I'd like to see it work. I think, it's not without precedent. There's a House version of this. It's been around, I think, since 2016. It probably hasn't been as certainly not as high profile as we've seen with this because of the people involved. A lot already seems to be going for it. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, senator who chairs the committee on, or is prominent in energy and natural resources, and is instrumental in these discussions, is on board, and others I think will soon follow. So let's hope that this is a way that things can get done, because I think if Democrats are looking at ahead, and even if everything breaks their way and they somehow regain control of the Senate, we saw something last week that indicated that they still can't, it's not a cakewalk in terms of their policies. Yeah. We saw on the Environmental Protection Agency vote where there was an attempt to effectively dial back the administration had done with the Obama emissions standards, and it failed because there were three defections from the Democratic caucus. And that shows that you can't, even if you have a majority, you still need to work with people across the aisle.
Yeah. How important is this going to be, regardless of what happens in the 2020 election, essentially? How important is this sort of bipartisan group going to be going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what they absolutely have to do. And honestly, it's worth a try. I mean, everything's worth a try, right? I mean, the one worry or concern about, you know, the people, that caucus, I'm worried that the only people who will join it or sort of participate are people who already have an open mind. And so the key is to get people who are the strident, you know, ones on the ends to try to come in and on either side, you know, learn more and look at new data and things like that.
Yeah, is really the next step at this point to see how serious this can be really about now who else joins. He mentioned Lisa Murkowski, and that's a big get, but how much of it is going to be as much sheer raw numbers as anything else?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have a very polarized D.C. that you're working with. You have, I think this is great to have two people from two sides of the aisle coming together to solve a very important climate crisis that we're in. It's an important issue. The struggle is going to be how do you find enough people and pass a policy that at the end of the day can move through an administration that's rolling back EPA protections and a Democratic Congress where there are certain members of that Congress, of that caucus, that kind of want to go from like park to fifth with environmental climate change policy. So finding that middle ground is going to be their challenge.
It struck me that, I mean, Mike Braun is obviously conservative. Chris Coons is really not. I mean, it's not like he's a moderate Democratic senator. Mm-hmm. Let me ask about the political of this. Does this help, hurt, or not make much of a difference for Mike Braun in Indiana?
I think it. I think right now it doesn't make much of a difference. I think potentially it helps. I don't think it hurts him. I think it may help him with some swing voters, but number one, I think it's incredibly refreshing, and I really applaud Senator Braun for doing this and doing this, you know, kind of right out of the gate. But what we're seeing, Indiana Conservative Alliance for Energy has a poll that shows Hoosier Republicans are overwhelmingly in support of increasing renewable energy options in the state, and we're seeing all kinds, you know, farmers who are using wind and solar to supplement farm income, and Republicans, millennials and younger Republicans, are also embracing clean energy. And the fact is, it's cheaper and cleaner, and those options are more like more practical now. And so I think it's a direction that we're going to head.
All right. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/iwir. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.